Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies program titled Haiti's Barren Devate and the Black Atlantic. Our speaker is Marlena Dout, Professor of African American Studies at University of Virginia. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Joseph Rezik, Associate Professor of English at Boston University.
Marlena Dout is Associate Director and Professor of African American Studies and American Studies at the University of Virginia. She is the author of two extraordinary books, Tropics of Haiti, Race and the Literary History of the Haitian Revolution in the Atlantic World from 2015, and most recently, Barren Devate and the Origins of Black Atlantic Humanism from 2017. Professor Dout's work lies at the intersection of early Caribbean studies, literary studies, African-American studies, early American studies, and early modern French colonial literary and historical studies. It combines the best, in my opinion, of historical research, literary analysis, and cultural criticism. Her latest book, On Vate, assesses that writer's biography, intellectual achievement, political career, and global legacy as an abolitionist critic and theorist of colonialism and slavery. As will be totally evident tonight, hi, welcome. Vate should be regarded as one of the most important literary and political voices of the 19th century. His searing histories and reflections on colonialism and slavery represent the most powerful indictment of racism, racial terror, and racial subjection of any writer of the period. As Dout has shown in her book on Vate and a series of related articles, many of his works were translated into English immediately and disseminated in both Britain and the United States, where they were met with both astonishment and incredulity. Dout's recent book makes her one of the world's leading scholars on Vate. So much of what I and others have learned from him comes from her work and analysis. Dout's career, of course, is about much more than one writer, as her first book and subsequent projects attest. She's a theorist and historian of race and literature, a leading scholar of the literature of the Haitian Revolution. She edits a very important online resources for scholars of Haiti and Haitian print culture, and is engaged at present on a collaborative project entitled An Anthology of Haitian Revolutionary Fictions. Without further ado, then, allow me to introduce Professor Dout to the podium. Her talk is called Haiti's Barren Devate and the Black Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I just wanted to thank Professor Rezik for inviting me here and for reaching out and being so interested in this really relatively little-known Haitian author. So Barren Devate is one of the most prolific writers from early 19th century Haiti. And I often find that the best way to get to know him is to really sort of jump right in and hear about his writings and be able to sort of experience his words. So I'm going to start in a moment with a series of quotes that I've kind of categorized that will give us a sense of the sort of vastness of his work, the kinds of projects he was interested in. When I first began to be interested in the Haitian Revolution, I didn't really stop there. 1804 was just the beginning for me. I wanted to find out what happened in Haiti after 1804, and I began to read Haitian writers, and I came across Barren Devate, whose name kept popping up sort of in passing, but there was no book on Barren Devate, for example. There were not very many articles on his writings that sought to analyze them, for example, from a literary perspective, and there was very little information about who he was as a person. So the first thing I set about doing was to try to think about these 11 works and how I'm going to read really what is an enormous corpus that makes him the most prolific writer in all of early 19th century Haiti. I should also mention that Vate's importance goes far beyond just the fact that he wrote these 11 book-length works. He was also the secretary to King Henri Christophe from 1811 until his death in 1820. And if you recall, during this time period, Haiti had been split into two separate states. So King Henri Christophe was ruling in the north. He had been a president since 1807 and established a monarchy in 1811. And Alexandre Pétion had established a republic in the south. So Vate becomes the principal writer from the Northern Kingdom, and these are the 11 works that he publishes in addition to editing the principal newspaper, La Gazette Royale d'Haïti. So one of the first things I noticed when I read Vate's work was something sort of evident that I kind of expected, is that it was extremely anti-slavery. This was expected, of course, because even in the days of Toussaint Louverture, the 1801 Constitution is remarkable because it abolishes slavery forever. Slavery is also abolished by the 1804 Declaration of Haitian Independence, in the 1805 Constitution, and in every constitution subsequently after that. So I wasn't surprised to find anti-slavery thought in Vate's writing, but the way that he phrased his anti-slavery ideas, I think, are very important, especially when we consider that this is 1814. He said, "The friends of slavery, those eternal enemies of the human race, have written thousands of volumes freely. They have made all the presses in Europe groan for entire centuries in order to reduce the black man below the brute. The small number of our unfortunate class have had a difficult time to throw even some small retorts against their numerous calumnies, having been compromised by the confluence of all the circumstances that smothered their voices." This phrase, "eternal enemies of the human race," is one that Vate will repeat in subsequent writings. He is also highly attuned to the kinds of writings emanating principally from Europe at the time period, writings that he said defamed black people and justified slavery. So one of his projects will be to sort of dismantle a pro-slavery writing by using what we would think of today as kind of discourse analysis, by laying out their arguments and showing what was illogical about them. He also was sort of principal in turning the word colonist into an epithet, essentially. He says, "Only the colonists could have invented this abominable traffic. Hardened to crime, habituated to lacerate and tear apart men with whips, accustomed to feasting upon the tears and blood of the Indians, only they could have invented such a monstrosity." And this became sort of very similar to me to the way that Aimé Césaire, for example, in Discourse on Colonialism, really kind of draws a through line from the conquest of the Americas to the slave trade, to the establishment of slavery and colonialism, all the way through to the Holocaust, which he says, here you have the principle, the end, once you begin treating human beings this way, right? And so Vate helped to sort of turn this word colonial from being a rather innocent descriptor. The French used it all the time to refer to themselves, is how we can sort of tell. And Vate turned it into really this epithet that he charges people with constantly in his writings. So that leads to another strain that is really important, that seems self-evident to us now, but when we remember again that it's 1814, and being anti-colonial is actually remarkable. Haiti has instituted an anti-imperial, anti-colonial republic in the middle of the Atlantic world. When Dessalines crowns himself an emperor in 1805, he's going to be an emperor with no empire, as Vate will point out, because Article 36 of the Haitian Constitution of 1805 bans the emperor from ever expanding the territory of Haiti beyond the island of Haiti, Quisqueya, its indigenous names, Hispaniola, its name from the 15th century forward. So Vate said, "History will be astonished that such a dreadful system, the colonial system, whose very foundation was built upon violence, rape, plunder, and treachery, has found zealous apologists among the enlightened nations of Europe. Posterity will never believe that at an age of enlightenment like ours, men who call themselves savants, philosophers, would have wanted to turn other men into animals, thereby contradicting the fact that primitive man has only one origin, solely in order to conserve their atrocious privilege of being able to oppress a part of humankind. Where are we indeed in an era of enlightenment in which all the great geniuses were born with grace to their countries with immortal works?" One of his principal projects was to dismantle pseudoscientific theories of race, which you see reflected in this comment about primitive man only having one origin. So he's really pushing back against polygenetic arguments by making an argument for monogenism. He also pushes back against the natural historians, who he says have papered over the earth with their writings that support solely to support slavery and colonialism. But he takes Enlightenment writers to task themselves. Enlightenment writers we don't normally associate with slavery. For example, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire, and says, why did they not speak out more strongly against slavery? They make vague comments, for example, Rousseau in the Discourse on the Origins of Inequality, or in Julie ou la Nouvelle Héloïse, of course, the famous scene in Voltaire's Candide. But why didn't they do more to end slavery? And why did they allow pseudoscientific racist beliefs to seep into their works, including in the writings of someone like Baron de Montesquieu? In a separate work from the same year called Notes to Mr. the Baron Malouet, Malouet was a colonist, Vaté made it very clear that Haiti did not seek to emulate the colonialism of the empires of the Atlantic world, namely Britain and France. He said the revolution did not transfer from the whites to the blacks the question of control of the West Indies. Haiti is one of the islands of this archipelago and is not itself the Caribbean. This was really influenced by Dessalines' 1804 constitution, in which he said, revolutionary destroyers that we are not going to become legislators of the Caribbean. This language would then be echoed in the 1806 constitution, 1807, 1811, and in fact, this anti-imperial language would last all the way until the overthrow of Boyer in 1843. So establishing this sort of anti-slavery, anti-colonial state. And of course, the state is going to be anti-racist. Now, of course, the word they used in the 19th century was color prejudice. So Dessalines' 1805 constitution had actually outlawed any color prejudice in the island. And this sort of filters into Vaté's writings. He says, are the physical and moral qualities specific to mankind prejudiced when it comes to differences in skin color? Strength, courage, virtue, and vice, good or bad habits, do they originate in the skin or rather in the hearts of men? So this sounds sort of similar to earlier Black Atlantic authors like Ignatius Sancho or Toba Cugolano. But here's where Vaté sort of gets very interesting in his understanding of the capacity for anti-racist writing to change discourse specifically about Haiti. He says, what Haiti needs is a general history written by someone native to the country. The majority of historians who have tried it have been Europeans who concerned themselves primarily with the part of our history that involves them. And when they were led by the subject at hand to speak of the natives, they did so with that spirit of prejudice and bias that they never seemed to be able to abandon. Vaté was one of, if not the first historian to say history could have a color, and that so far Haiti's history had been a very white one. And he said, until Haitians write their own history, we will not see the truth, the light of truth, as he called it, come forward. Later, British and French and U.S. historians would adopt this very language to describe the biases of historians. I'm thinking of James Redpath in the U.S. context, or Victor Schellcher in France, William Beard in England, who wrote a biography, or John Beard, rather, of Toussaint Louverture. So the final characteristic I want to bring forward at this moment is the black sovereignty, the argument for black sovereignty. One of the really important strands in his work is that this anti-racist, anti-slavery, anti-colonial philosophy is highly institutionalized. It's sanctioned by the state. Vaté is a state writer. I mentioned he's the secretary of Christophe. So it's literally a part of the institution of Haiti as a state. But it is also about the way that black freedom and black sovereignty needs to be institutionalized. So one of the main differences you'll see when you read Vaté's writings is a lack of attention to how his personal biography and personal narrative can sort of drive the argument for freedom and equality forward. Vaté is very interested in how freedom and equality should be replicated over time in various other places. Now, of course, you can see why his writings would be, people would fear them in the Atlantic world, because the powers that be in Jamaica, in a story I'll tell you a little bit later, can very well see that even if Vaté never mentions Jamaica once, which he doesn't, you can see how his words could have application in Jamaica. So someone bringing the text there, that would sort of count as sedition. But his defense of black sovereignty is two-pronged, because he has to defend it on the basis of the revolution. Remember, later he'll say, our revolution is being misunderstood. People are saying that we're just cutting people's heads off and burning fields. And there were famous images circulating all around the Atlantic world. I'm sure you've seen many of them, with black people holding up white people's heads on pikes and by the hair. So he's got to change understandings of the revolution. He has to encourage the belief that the revolution was righteous. He says, "I am far from wanting to dispute the right that other nations have had to render themselves independent, but I dare affirm, without fear of being contradicted, that no people has had more right to liberty and independence than the people of Haiti." He also needs to defend Haitian sovereignty on the grounds of the monarchy. I mentioned that Henri Christophe had instituted a monarchy in 1811. This was complicated because, of course, Europe, France, for example, is bouncing back and forth between different systems of governance. We have a monarchy in England. But the Americas are moving in an opposite direction, to quote the Abbé Grégoire. Of course, there's the United States that has a republic. But on the other side of the island, or rather the other side of the island that is Haiti at this moment, we have a republic that Alexandre Pétion claims he designed to replicate that of the United States. Now, this is also problematic because even though the United States was touting itself as the beacon of liberty and equality, Vate can very well see that they're not, because they still have enslaved Africans. There's lots of slaves in the United States. And so Vate points that out. He points out that it's not necessarily the case that a republic is better than a monarchy, because we don't see the end of slavery in the United States. So this was sort of his kind of gotcha moment for promulgating a monarchy on the one hand. But on the other hand, he pointed out that really what a lot of people had a problem with was that Christophe was a black king. He says, "There you have what the French publicists, the journalists, the creators of colonial systems cannot digest. One would say to hear them that a black king is a phenomenon that has never been seen in the world. Who will therefore reign over the blacks if the blacks cannot be kings? Is royalty such a privilege that it belongs exclusively to the white color?" So his defense is from sort of multiple aspects, down to monarchies are ordinary and normal, to, well, you are only against us because we have a black king. So strains that writers have pointed out. So those who mention Vate's writing in passing, usually in talking about other phenomena in Black Atlantic thought, have pointed out that it speaks to issues of the Enlightenment, that not simply arguing against it, but that certain facets of Vate's writing actually reflect Enlightenment thought. For example, the way that he questions his interlocutors and then provides an answer, right? The sort of way that he constructs his argument. Of course, abolitionist thought that had already been sort of popular in England, in 18th century England. And then things that were more familiar in our world, for example, negritude and post-colonial theory. So Vate's centrality to theorizing post-slavery Atlantic world has caused scholars like Laurie Mathley Kipp to compare him to Baron de Montesquieu. I always wonder what he would think about that, since he wrote against Montesquieu. To David Walker, sort of this fiery language, to William Lloyd Garrison. Then there are those who've seen comparisons, have made direct comparisons to the writings of Frantz Fanon, particularly in Black Skin, White Masks, and in The Wretched of the Earth. And I've actually written about Vate in connection with Aimé Césaire, who wrote about Vate in one of his plays. And Jean-Paul Sartre has a little-known essay called Colonialism as a System, in which he sort of talks and uses some of the similar kinds of arguments that Vate was using. So as I'm sort of trying to get to know Vate, I'm wondering how many people knew about his writings in the 19th century outside of Haiti, people especially even beyond the British abolitionist community that was, many British abolitionist writers had visited Haiti. Prince Saunders, for example, lived there for a while and started a school in Port-de-Paix in the north of Haiti. And I found that there were quite a lot of mentions. So what I had initially thought of as, well, this is a person who's really not that well known, it turns out that he may not be that well known now, but in another era, people definitely seem to have considered and understood and known about his writings. On three separate occasions, his writing appeared in Freedom's Journal, for example, in 1828, in English translation. James McCune Smith, in his 1841 a lecture on the Haitian revolutions, mentioned Vate in passing and quoted from The Colonial System Unveiled. W.E.B. Du Bois listed Vate in his 1905 a select bibliography of Americana, African Americana. Alain Locke in The Negro Digs Up His Past in 1925, Arturo Schomburg in several essays, Mae Miller, who was a playwright, whom Carter G. Woodson had asked to write a play about the Haitian Revolution, and the play she wrote was called Christophe's Daughters, and it was published in a book of four plays in 1935, and Vate is a character in the play. I was also interested in what do Haitians say about Vate today and beyond? And I found mentions of him in texts of Haitian literary history. For example, Du Racine Vava's History of Haitian Literature, and the subtitle there, Où l'âme noire, is Or the Black Soul. And he has this sort of very poignant phrase, even as he doesn't go in depth into Vate's works, because it's sort of like a, you know, he gives a couple of paragraphs to each writer he's describing. But he says, one does not know history if one does not know Vate. I thought, well, that's a serious charge. So I bet I should keep on going and see where I can take this. And I would find passing mentions of him, for example, in Silencing the Past. Trouillot uses Vate's writing to talk about the palace at Sanssouci. But I still wasn't finding the kind of in-depth articles and notebook about him that I thought someone who was this prolific and this important to early 19th century Haiti would have. So I thought, where is he in Black Atlantic thought? Why doesn't Gregoire talk about him in the book, in his De la Littérature des Nègres? Well, partially it's that Vate hasn't published The Colonial System Unveiled yet. It's 1808. So I think, okay, and Vate read that work. Maybe that encouraged him to write. But those who were studying the writings of Alada Equiano, Phyllis Wheatley, Ignatius Sancho, Otaba Cugoano, other early Afro-diasporic writers, Jupiter Hammond, Britton Hammond, didn't mention Vate either, and I was interested to find out why is that? Is there some reason other than perhaps they simply don't know about Vate? If that were the case, I thought, well, that's pretty easy to fix. We can, you know, start writing articles about Vate, and we can see where it goes. But in trying to figure out who Vate was, I found my literary training bumping up against the kind of training that I needed to actually think about who he was and figure out who he was. So I was trained as a literary critic, but my first book was a literary history. So I had already had to sort of figure out all of these skills about book history and how to trace the reception history and how to sort of lay that all out and make arguments about it. So I found myself, those were the things I was most comfortable with, literary criticism and literary history. So I thought, let me know Vate that way first. And so even though it sort of seems backwards here that I would start with biography, I have put these points in the talk and on this slide in the order to which I came to them, which ended up being quite fruitful because there are things when you are studying someone's life that don't seem important to you because there's nothing that's jumped out about them that has signaled their importance. But because I was so mired in Vate's works already, some of the things I found in the archives when I went into his biography led me back to the readings to understand them in a new way. In the way that perhaps if I had figured out who his parents were and his parentage and his date of birth before all of that, I might not have have linked things in the same way or as immediately. So that's what I just set out to do. I was going to read and analyze the works. I was going to track their reception history in their own era and up until today. And then I was going to research into his life, who he was, by using archival documents. So you'll see that things didn't necessarily work out in that order because I started to find out that through reading the works, I could figure out a little bit about who Vate was. And it also led me to sort of categorize the writings anew. So in the first list I gave you, I just put them in chronological order. But once I sort of sorted through them and read them all, because initially, of course, I read The Colonial System Unveiled because that's such a provocative title. And then I read the ones that were arguing against France because I thought, oh, I got to read this. And then, of course, I wanted to read The History of Haiti. But some of the other works, the titles weren't jumping out at me because they seemed very particular about particular moments, things that were happening inside of Haiti. So I determined that there were kind of three broad categories, although the works sort of bleed into one another in certain respects as well. There were the historical writings, The Colonial System Unveiled, a more kind of journalistic writing about the coronation and anniversary of celebration for the queen, but that allowed Vatte to tell the story of how the monarchy came to be. And then that work of history, a daunting work of history, the first full-length history of the country in 1819. Then there were those works that really were like discourse analysis, like Aimé Césaire and Frantz Fanon, where they tackle a French writer or a British writer, and they point out the flaws in their arguments. So there were three of those works. And then there were writings that at first didn't seem as important to me. Vatte was making documentary claims. So except for the first two of these, almost all of them reference, even in the title, some document that Vatte is going to use to prove an argument. And the sort of two main arguments that Vatte proves through his use of documents are that Pétion is a traitor and terrible, and that the people of the South should reunite with the North. So this is one of the reasons I think Vatte's writings haven't been read as much, that there's a lot of polemics involved in the writing. And the other claim is that France is trying to retake the colony of Saint-Domingue. And he proves through these documents that he captures and republishes, and they spread all around the Atlantic world, I learned, that really, right after the Bourbon Restoration, an expedition was sent to Saint-Domingue, and they never make it there. They send three emissaries before, and the Haitians capture them on the northern side of the island. And if you believe the southern writers torture the particular spy, Franco de Medina, whom they capture, and interrogate him about his plans and find the instructions given to him by Malouet. Now suddenly the pieces are falling together. Vatte's writing against Malouet because Malouet was the minister of the Marines who sent these French spies to Haiti in order to retake the colony. It sort of sounds outlandish when you think about it. It's 1814. Why would they think they could read? Then again in 1815. And actually, as I sort of tracked this claim, I found French writers arguing that they should go retake their colony into the 1830s, and one outlying writer in the 1850s who still thinks we're going to reconquer Saint-Domingue. Vatte had a lot to say about that, as you might imagine. So in terms of what I knew, this is what I knew when I began to sort of read the works. This is what I knew about him. I knew from the letter that he wrote to Thomas Clarkson that he had to have been born in 1781, because he said that he was 39 years old, so I kind of counted back from the letter. He said exactly when his birthday was. He said he was nearly 39, I should say. Then Vatte claimed that he had served in the military under the revolutionary leader Toussaint Louverture's army at the age of 15. This was interesting because he described it as fighting in the Haitian army, but he was 15, that would have been 1796, so technically he would have been a French soldier. Toussaint Louverture was a French general at that time. Vatte also mentioned that he was married and that he had two daughters, Arissi and Malvina. Vatte is writing to Thomas Clarkson because he wants to convince Thomas Clarkson to make arguments to the British government to formally recognize Haitian independence. So there's sort of two things that happen in Haitian writing. On the one hand, they say, you've already recognized our independence. You call us Haiti instead of Saint-Domingue. You trade with us. You send your merchants to our ports. But in their private correspondence with influential people in England, they say, we want you to make arguments. They appeal to the Abbé Grégoire, who is, you know, persona non grata in France, actually, because the abolitionist movement becomes wildly unpopular there in the early 19th century. But they try him. They're trying to see who can be influential people who can help them to achieve formal recognition. But I found that there were, when I really went into the writings and I read them, cover to cover, there were autobiographical claims in there. I thought, Vatte doesn't talk about himself at all. He said, for example, that he had no formal education beyond CZM, which would be like junior high years. He says, it is not useless to warn my readers that I have never undertaken official study of the French language. They will excuse then certain faults of literature and speech and literature that will necessarily abound in the works of an islander who never had any other teacher than his books. It's not exactly right and I'll let you know about that when we get to the family letters portion, but it is true that he doesn't have the kind of formal education that some other free people of color had. It establishes a little bit about his parentage. Vatte said, having been given life by an African woman, I feel myself to be very African. He talked about his life in revolutionary Saint-Domingue. So if he was fighting under Toussaint Louverture, I sort of thought, well, maybe after the kidnapping of Louverture, he decided to fight on the side of the Armée Indigène. But no, as he tells it, didn't happen until very late, January of 1803, and he'd been fighting, that means, against the Haitian revolutionaries up until that point. He cited Rochambeau's genocidal tactics as the reason he ended up defecting from the French army to fight for the Armée Indigène. Leclerc and Rochambeau used dogs against the Haitian revolutionaries, but they also used what Claude Ribes, a French historian, describes as the crime of Napoleon, which is the sulfur boats. They loaded people of color onto the boats, they filled them with sulfur and gassed them, and then they dumped their bodies into the ocean. So Vaté says when he found himself hunted down, even though he was fighting on their side, because he was a person of color, he understood the error that he had made. He fled into the forest, he says, and he encountered the Haitian revolutionaries, and he thought, I'm done for. But he said, instead of repulsing me, and he said, which they would have had every right to do, they embraced me, they welcomed me into the maternal bosom, and I will never, ever disassociate my cause from theirs. So the question that David Nichols, the historian, had asked, which is, why is Vaté on the side of the Haitian revolutionaries, and why does he join the Haitian government, is answered, actually, by reading his works when we really sort of read into the narrative. He also talked about his life in post-independence Haiti. We wondered at some point, well, what was he doing in between? We didn't know any of his writings until 1814. But he says very clearly that he was the principal secretary for 7 years in the Department of Finances and the Interior, which would have been from 1804 to 1811. So first under Dessalines, actually, and then under Christophe. So when Dessalines is assassinated in October of 1806 and power changes hands, he goes with the Christophe side. So part two, then, that literary history. Now that I've really read the works, I figured out some things about him, I started to get back into the reception history, because if you recall, I started with Freedom's Journal, but that was 1828. I was really interested, did people know about Vaté's writing before that time? And I found out that they did, in fact. Baron de Vaté was an incredibly popular and widely read author in the Atlantic world. His works, if you sort of search through newspaper articles in the United States and England, you find him cited more than any other Haitian, cited more often than Toussaint Louverture. It makes sense. They're reviewing his works. They're advertising his works. So there were reviews, advertisements, and other mentions of his works as well in England, France, Italy, Switzerland, the United States, Jamaica, Germany, and the Netherlands. Vaté would exercise considerable influence over how the Haitian Revolution was discussed in the first half century of Haitian independence. He was the go-to. He was the person. That's why James McCune Smith cited him in his lecture on the Haitian Revolutions. He was the go-to Haitian writer. He was the most prolific one. He's the one whose name was known. And he's the one whose works had been translated into English. There were other Haitian authors publishing. Boisrond-Tonnerre publishes a memoir of the Haitian Revolution. That's Dessalines' sort of most prominent secretary in 1804. Juste Chanlot, who's also on the Christophe side, publishes two histories, one in 1804 and one in 1810, but they're not translated into English. And translation in general allows these works of Vaté's to circulate far and wide in the Atlantic world and to have enormous impact. And then as I'm looking into the reception history, I'm reading British newspapers for mentions of Vaté, I find an article that mentions a Dr. William Hamilton. It says he's a translator and he's translated this proclamation from the king, and here's his translation. And oh, by the way, if there's any errors in this, it's because Baron de Vaté is sick and couldn't check this translation. And I thought, WH, is that my, like, you know, something just, you know, I'm grasping at straws. I'm like, WH, but I have a problem because I'm like, where did the MB come from? So I decide to go try to figure out who William Hamilton is. And you can imagine that's a pretty common name. There was a Alexander Hamilton's son, there was a lawyer, a Scottish lawyer. I found a lot of William Hamilton's. But when I saw this memoir on the cultivation of wheat in the tropics, I thought, maybe that's my guy. And it was from 1840, and lo and behold, he mentions his talented and lamented friend, Baron de Vaté, in the work. And I then subsequently read many articles, botanist articles, because I learned from going into the Kew Gardens in England, into their archives, that in his application for a Radcliffe Traveling Fellowship, William Hamilton mentioned that was his evidence that he should have the fellowship, that he lived in Haiti, that he'd lived in St. Lucia, and that he'd been to Jamaica. And so he talked about it. And he often used Vaté's writings, including in this memoir on wheat in the tropics, to bolster his arguments for botany. And there's three pages in this memoir on the on why slavery's wrong. So he folds that in there as well. But then there's other. He says Verrin de Vaté said that the colonists only, that they only liked these crops because those are the crops that can enrich them. But wheat is a crop that can feed people. So we need to basically. He's making sort of this anti-capitalist argument, and he uses Vaté's writing to do so. So I'm sort of astonished now because here I have read all of these works from my first book on natural history and how natural science supported the ends of empire, and here I have a guy who. This application got denied, by the way. here I have a botanist who is now making anti-slavery, anti-imperial arguments. Now, of course, it's 1840, and so English has already abolished slavery, so maybe he feels kind of justified on that end. But true to Eric Williams' thesis in Capitalism and Slavery, he says, what about Brazil? Let's turn away from the Caribbean. Let's go think about Brazil, which is part of Williams' thesis, is that abolitionists were very strong against slavery in the Caribbean, but unfree labor, they didn't really speak out against it. In fact, they argued for forms of slavery in Brazil and in South America. And you see that in this application, he says, I'll go to Brazil. I'm totally fine with that, right? He's decided that the Caribbean is a kind of slavery-free space and a space that should have, he calls sort of like democratic labor to a certain extent, but these don't extend into Brazil. So he sort of supports the ends of empire, but not fully. But in the course of trying to figure out who he was, I say this is like the most accidental history I think maybe anyone's ever written. I'm in the Jamaica National Archives because Hamilton said he went to Jamaica. And what do I find? I can't believe it. I find mention of a Thomas Strafford who is indicted because he brings back Vaté's reflections on a letter from Mazer into Kingston. And the indictment on this roll, this register, is 38 pages. It's the longest indictment. Why is it 38 pages? Because whoever is writing this indictment quotes from the original French and then their original translations into English. This indictment is written before Hamilton's translation comes out in March of 1817, because we are in February of 1817. And the indictment is completely activist. In parentheses, it'll say the usurped, cursed person called Christophe, the wicked defier of all humanity, Christophe, right? And I'm thinking, surely this is not the basis for him to be convicted. And in fact, he would be convicted in February of 1817 for spreading or publishing several wicked, scandalous, malicious seditions and inflammatory libels. The evidence for that, the passages that were being quoted, it was astonishing. I thought they were going to be the passages where he says France and the colonists and they're terrible and horrible and cut off all their heads, because those passages exist. The principal passage was this statement of black humanity. I have been tempted 20 times to throw away my pen, Vaté said. I feel humiliated. I am a man. I feel it to be so in all of my being. I possess all of the faculties. I have thought, reason, strength. I have every sense of my sublime existence. And I find myself obliged to refute puerile arguments, absurd sophisms, just to prove to men like me that I am their equal. Strafford's defense. So when I found mention of the Strafford case in two Jamaican newspapers, the Royal Gazette of Jamaica and the St. Iago Gazette, I learned a little bit more. He was convicted of, yes, bringing seditious material into Jamaica, but without malicious intent. Strafford's defense was that some French housekeeper in Haiti must have just slipped these books into his, or this book rather, into his suitcase, into his belongings, and that he had no idea that they were there. But what do I find when I go looking for him in Haitian newspapers? He's at the palace. He's mentioned in the August 22nd, 1816 article. He's mentioned in August 24th. And remember, he doesn't leave until the winter. So he's there and he's living there for quite a long time. He's having a lavish dinner. He's sitting at a table with guess who? Baron de Vatte. So it's interesting to me that he uses this defense. It gets him a lesser charge. He has to pay a fine, and he only has to have is sentenced to the jail time that he already had served while he was waiting for his trial. So this brings me to the final part, the biography. So now I'm really interested in who Vatte is, and because I have kind of done some of this archival work, I understand where I need to go to find out who he is. So I go into the National Archives of France in the Outre-mer, the Outer Seas archives in Aix-en-Provence, because, of course, while Baron de Vatte is associated with Haiti, when he was born, Haiti was a French colony, so that's where the civil registers of all the people born in the colony to free and legitimate birth would be. So it established his name, actually, as Jean-Louis Vatte, rather than Pompey Valentin Vatte. And I'll tell you in a moment how we know for sure that that's the case. But it also established his date of birth, so it was exactly what, as he had said in that Thomas Clarkson letter. It established his parentage as legitimate, and his legal status is free. Now, James McCune Smith, when he'd mentioned him in 1841, had said, a former slave. He was a slave for 20 years before he wrote these writings. Because remember how important it is for abolitionists to say, here's a formerly enslaved person who is now writing. But the baptismal certificate, the record, actually shows that not only was he a free person of color, but his parents were married. He was born of legitimate birth. It lists the names of his parents, so Marie-Françoise Elisabeth Dumas, his mother, and his father, Jean Vatte. In the civil register, I also found the marriage certificate of his parents, which gave me even more information about him, that his father was from Jumièges, France, in Normandy, that he came to the colony in 1769. It establishes his mother as having been a free woman of color. So now this wasn't mentioned in the baptismal certificate because she's now a married woman. She's married to a white man. So there is not mention of her parentage in that document. It calls her a fille naturelle, which means that she was the illegitimate daughter of a white planter who turns out to be a famous white planter named Pierre Dumas, who's listed on the document only as a witness because he's married to someone else. So it links Vatte's mother and his maternal grandfather, Pierre Dumas, to Le Système Colonial des Voilés. I remembered that these were names that were mentioned in the colonial system unveiled. And so he had actually did tell a story about his mother beyond just saying she was the African woman who gave him life. There's this moving reference to Elisabeth Mimi Dumas, which is exactly how she's referenced in her marriage certificate. He calls her fille naturelle of Dumas, a planter from Marmelade, currently a property owner in France. So his grandfather had fled from revolutionary France, Haiti back to France. So after describing how Mimi saved an infant slave named Laurent from being thrown into an oven by her own father, thus Vatte's grandfather. So he's not only mentioning his parents, he's telling a horrible story about who his grandfather is without naming him as such. He says that his mother, this allows him to praise his mother. He says, virtuous and kind Mimi, you are no longer, but you enjoy in our hearts eternal blessings as the reward for your good deeds. Your friend here consecrates your name and your virtues for the veneration and the friendship of all kind and sensitive hearts. So now I'm sort of very, very interested in finding out if there's other references. Are many of the other people he mentions in this work, are they people he knew? But I thought it was also getting me very close to understanding how to answer the question, why don't more people know about Vatte, specifically about the colonial system unveiled? And with how popular of a writer he was in the 19th century and up into the 20th century being mentioned by famous African-American historians and writers, why is there no full translation of the colonial system unveiled until 2014? Remember, Mercer Cook, one of the reasons that his name is known to Haitians is that along with Langston Hughes, he translates the Haitian novelist Jacques Roumain's Gouverneur de la Rosée into Masters of the Dew in 1947. So there were translators around who could have undertaken this work. Arthur Schomburg, also another one. I think partially it has to do with the way that Vatte wrote the colonial system unveiled. That takes on this kind of testimonial quality that actually seems very similar to a form of our current world, the testimonio. He said, the facts that I recount bear every stamp of truth. I collected them from the survivors of those families whose kin experienced these acts of torture. These witnesses are irreproachable. And then again, that epithet colonists who still exist, listen to me. I'm going to awaken the ashes of the numerous victims whom you precipitated into the tomb and borrow their voices to unveil your heinous crimes. I'm going to exhume those miserable victims whom you buried alive. I'm going to ask the souls of my unfortunate compatriots whom you have thrown alive into blazing ovens, those whom you have stabbed, macerated, impaled, and a thousand other diverse torments invented by hell. And this is exactly what he will describe for pages and pages and pages, dozens of planters by name. I will provide the names of these guilty colonists, and I defy any of them to contradict me, because they were still alive, and he was defaming them. And newspapers would write about the different families, particularly in the United States, the Gallifet family and the de Cockburn family, that Vate had described them as being these terrible people. But one of the things that happens after you read this catalog of abuses is there's no triumph at the end. No one wins. The colonial system unveiled is not about the Haitian Revolution. It's a justification for the Haitian Revolution. This is why the Haitian Revolution happened. But it doesn't say, now our work is done. In fact, it argues that slavery, that the slave trade needs to be abolished all over the world, and that slavery itself needs to be abolished. So there's the lack of the kind of triumph over adversity in these accounts that helped the works of Equiano and Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs to be read in novelistic manner. Remember Frederick Douglass's famous fight with Covey, where he gets to say that now he's being returned to the status of a man. Or Harriet Jacobs, who's even more emphatic, my story ends with freedom, reader, and even though that's not saying a lot in the big grand system of things, it is saying a great deal for me and for my children. But I think that ultimately part of the reason why he's not read is the catalog of abuses, right? That is really tough. When I teach to students, I mean, they're moved in ways that they don't necessarily understand by having to read. They want to know, is this really true? It's one of the first things they ask is, did all of these things really happen? But there's also the element of race. Vate had never been an enslaved person himself. He couldn't claim, like an Equiano or Frederick Douglass or Harriet Jacobs, to have been in that condition and on that basis to really understand it and be offering that information to the public. He himself, according to observers, was phenotypically white with red hair. He had this father from Normandy. His mother was a quote-unquote quadroon in the parlance of the day. We don't have any images of Vate. The court of Henri Christophe had their images painted often, but we don't have any images of him. When I began to look for images, I found only this one painting from 1953. I don't know which of these people is supposed to be Baron de Vate, but the title of the painting is King Henry I, Baron de Vate. And there's other people there, but they're not in the title of the work. So I'm not exactly sure which of those people is supposed to be Baron de Vate. I also sort of was interested in him as part of the state, of course, and it seemed to me like that was another reason, because I would find statements like, is he a propagandist or is he the defender of black freedom? And I thought, well, those are two interesting things to kind of push up against each other. And very often in many of those passing mentions that I described or alluded to, it would say the publicist Vate or the propagandist Vate, which gives the sense that he's not really, quote unquote, an authentic intellectual, that he's writing on behalf of the state. He was a part of this radical sort of black intellectual tradition in the early 19th century, but yes, he is also a part of the state. And I just have here the words, if you can see them. This is his coat of arms. The Armorial of Haiti, which is held by the Royal College of London, contains the coat of arms of all of Christophe's nobility. And his says sincerity, frankness, although, of course, many of those same observers who described what he looked like for us told us he was anything but. They told us he had a terrible personality. They told us that he did terrible things. And I think that these accounts, especially the British accounts, did have an effect sort of moving forward in terms of who is a noble hero, that it was hard to recuperate him as a person who had really suffered under slavery, as a person who was noble, that it seemed really complicated to think about him as a hero. But why we should read Vate, I think, is because this tension between his sort of wish to uphold radical black state power, but dismantle white colonial power, is a tension that didn't disappear or only was characteristic of the Haitian Revolution. We have this tension in the writings of someone like Aimé Césaire, who was principal advocate for French departmentalization, becomes the mayor of Fort-de-France for many decades, right? We have this dynamic to a certain extent with Kwame Nkrumah, with Léopold Sédar Senghor, with other black intellectuals who gave us radical things to think about, radical terminology about neocolonialism, about negritude, etc., but who did end up becoming arms of various kinds of states and sometimes problematic kinds of state and had status positions that were problematic. So I think that when we kind of reposition Vaté in his own world, we understand him as a part of the world he came from, which doesn't mean that we can't criticize him or think about what were some of the flaws in his thinking, but we can see that the black intellectual tradition, especially the radical black intellectual, is often at once populist and authoritative, radical and conservative. And finally, I think we need more nuance, not less, when we try to understand how black sovereignty is constructed in this hostile world of chattel slavery. One of the things Vaté says over and over again is, no people have ever had to argue for their existence to this extent, to deal with outside threats simply because of their skin color, for the United States to hover in the distance, for France to want to retake them. They also have a threat on the other side of the island, as the French are in control initially, and then the Spanish come to control on the eastern two-thirds of the island. So there are enormous threats against Haiti. And then, of course, there's trade embargoes from Thomas Jefferson, and there's a lack of desire and a complete disavowal of their independence, even as these states try to enrich themselves off of Haiti by continuing to trade with them, whether it is illegally or whether it is legal. And so these are the reasons I think, and I hope I've convinced you, that this is someone that we should at least want to know more about, that this is just the beginning, I think, of the kinds of Vaté that we can uncover by actually reading his writings and trying to figure out what we can learn from them today, and what we learn essentially about early 19th century black writing from reading his works. So thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Marlena Dout, professor of African American Studies at University of Virginia. Professor Dout's lecture was titled Haiti's Baron de Vaté and the Black Atlantic and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Joseph Rezik, associate professor of English at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.